It's a pleasure to be with you and talk about some subject I continue to work on. And so I would appreciate your feedback if the ideas I put out make sense or don't make sense, if they're consistent or not. So the main thing I'm interested is in divine action and how to account for divine action in the world. And as you see in the title, my talk is mainly destructive, but not only. I prefer something else in the place. So perhaps from the outset I can say that I'm pretty sure about the destructive bit. I really don't think that it works, what the standard accounts of divine action, which you find in the literature, and I'll come to it in a minute. I'm less sure about the constructive bit, so I would especially appreciate feedback on my own proposal. So against physicalism plus God, how creation accounts for divine action in the world. So let us start with what you find in the literature on divine action. And in fact, I will run parallel divine and human action, because it's easier in a certain sense to reason about human action than about divine action. And if an account fails for human action, I would say it also fails for divine action. So if it can't do the easier case, then it won't do for the more complicated case. And what you find in the literature, there's quite a bit of interest over the last decades on divine action. You find scientists, theologians, using contemporary physics to account for divine action. And so different authors do it in different ways. So I'm thinking of Robert Russell, for example, John Polkinghorne, Arthur Peacock. But there is a kind of standard belief that it's easier to account for divine action using contemporary physics. And I'm not going to explain in length these accounts. I suppose that many of you are familiar with them. But just to say from the outset, but I don't think that contemporary physics makes it any easier to account for divine action than classical physics. So neither quantum mechanics nor case theory provide more room for divine action than classical physics. Let me say a word on quantum mechanics. Many people think that quantum mechanical indeterminacies provide some space for divine action, but I think there are several reasons not to accept this. First, quantum mechanical probabilities do not stem from our ignorance, but are genuine features of the system. For example, if the position of a system is known, its momentum is undetermined. And more generally, two complementary observables are jointly determined only above the limits indicated by Heisenberg's uncertainty relation. But this indeterminacy is not epistemological. It's objective. It's not only the case that we don't know the value, but even the hypothetical attribution of the exact value would lead to a contradiction with the laws of quantum mechanics. And here I'm referring to Bell's inequalities. Thus, as long as the laws of quantum mechanics are valid, and this is a presupposition in all these models, not even an omniscient being could know the exact value or could determine, not even an omnipotent being could determine this value, because it's just undetermined, objectively. And also, some other people, so this is Robert Russell's account, other people have tried to use the non-locality of quantum mechanics to make some space for God's action. But once again, if you use the results of the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen experiment, you see that the non-local properties don't give you any more room for divine action. In particular, you can't transmit information through these non-local interactions. And so what use would it be, even if you could, to use these EPR correlations for divine action? And there is an additional argument which comes from neuroscience and work calculations which Peter Clark has done. He has asked the similar question, if quantum mechanics can account for human liberty. And then he has done the calculations and showed that quantum mechanical effects are several magnitudes too small, in fact, to account or to be of influence for brain states. And so if quantum mechanics doesn't allow us to explain human action, why would it give us room for divine action? And chaos theory is not better, because chaos theory is typically classical chaos theory, so we don't know much about quantum mechanical chaos. So chaotic systems are deterministic, and so if there is a problem for divine action in deterministic systems, then there is also a problem for divine action in chaotic systems. And so I don't think that quantum mechanics or chaos theory can give us anything good in terms of accounting for divine action. And perhaps just add a word that Newton, for example, didn't think that there was any problem for divine action in his classical deterministic world. So we have to challenge the other presupposition. But so I don't think that quantum mechanics gives us anything. I don't think that chaos theory gives us anything. And there is another approach which is in the literature. It's non-reductive physicalism. So non-reductive physicalism is discussed typically in neurosciences. So it's people like Nancy Murphy, Brown, or Joel Green. I don't know if you've read the book, What Happened to the Soul? So these are evangelicals trying to accommodate recent neuroscientific findings with a classical concept of the soul, or perhaps not of the soul, but of human action and human consciousness and thinking. And the model is non-reactive physicalism. And there are writers, authors in the field, which tries to use a similar account for divine action. So I use the expression non-reactive physicalism plus God. So it's a kind of analog. Yes? You use non-reactive physicalism known from neurosciences then to account for divine actions, for divine action. Once again, I don't think that it works, basically, because I believe that non-reductive physicalism doesn't work, and so for human action. And once again, if it doesn't work for human action, why would it be any good for divine action? And let me give you... So I'll come back to this point on the next slide. But on the root of all of this, on all these accounts, I think there is a kind of idolization of science, and in particular physics. And in order to get a workable account of divine action, or perhaps not a workable, but in a satisfactory account of divine action, I think that the only way forward will be to challenge the presupposition of physicalism, will be to challenge the presupposition that science is the point where we have to start. So I'll get back to this point later. One word on non-reductive physicalism. First of all, the definition. Non-reductive physicalism tries to hold together two theses which seem to be conflicting, and in fact, in my opinion, they are conflicting. But authors writing in the field think that that you can hold them together. So the first thesis is about physicalism, is about the closure of the physical world. You know, there are only physical objects, and especially if you apply it to the brain, the physical description of the brain is complete. But they don't want to be reductive physicalists, so they add a second thesis. Mental states supervene on brain states, and they exert a causal influence So typically people would speak about top-down causality. Because if... So it's quite easy, in fact, to accept that there are mental states just, say, on top of the brain states, but that doesn't give you any significance for, say, human thought and human action. To have a kind of robust model of human thought and of human action, you need a kind of causal influence of the mental states. If all the causal, say, the causality is done by the brain states, yeah, then the mind is just an epiphenomenon, which you can also just throw away. It's perhaps just we being conscious of... Just to explain, what they don't want you to have is a kind of, say, either identity between brain and mental states, or a kind of epiphenomenon that would be just mental states being on top of brain states, but without having any causal influence. So you need mental states which can exert a causal influence. So it should make a difference to the world that I think, say, that I'm speaking to you, that it's not just my brain states causing things. And so the key concept which is put forward in the literature is supervenience. Supervenience is an older term. In fact, it goes back to even Leibniz, but it was brought into the field in 1970 by David Davidson. And what does it mean, in fact? And there is a key problem, in fact. It is a term which is vague in its very definition. So I can read. I don't think that I was on a slide. Just let me. So what does supervenience mean? In fact, supervenience, or if you want a slogan, then it's no difference of one kind without a difference of another kind. So you can't get a difference between, say, mental states without having a difference on brain states. So that is the intuitive meaning. So if you want to change something in the mental states, you have to do some changing in the brain states. So that's the intuitive notion. But once you want to make it more precise, you run into trouble. Yeah. So Nancy Murphy, for example, gives the definition property S, which is the mental realm, is supervenient on property B, for basic, if and only if something instantiates S in virtue of its instantiating B under circumstance C. And then you have this in virtue of, and she adds, as a non-causal consequence of. And then you say, but what does it mean to instantiate S in virtue of or as a non-causal consequence of? You really haven't made any advance. And you can't, in fact. By definition, you can't, because if you were able to write down what it means to supervene, then in fact you would be back to a reductionist program, and you don't want to have this reductionism. Therefore, it's a kind of vague term, and at least I would say that the vagueness of the term hides the contradiction which is between the two theses, physicalism and non-reductionism, and Bas von Frasen has a very interesting analysis on this. You'll find the quote on the handout, where he compares, in fact, the supervenience theory or the supervenience concept to Leibniz's analysis of contingency. So Leibniz said something is contingent, a proposition is contingent if the proof of this proposition needs an infinite number of steps. So for God, everything is necessary. This was Leibniz's view of contingency. But for us, yeah, it's contingent because we can't do the infinite number of steps. But then, Bas von Frasen so takes it up and said, this is obviously a position designed to be irrefutable. Yeah? If we can't write down this supervenience relation, it's a position designed to be irrefutable. What are the benefits of believing in such a relation of persons to physical objects? the mere assurance of consistency, called comfort. Add to this that no such ideal physicalistic language exists or is likely ever to be had. Why play these games? And I would like to add, why believe physicalism in the first place? So, against physicalism. It's pretty difficult, in fact, to define what is physicalism. It's something like physics describes the world as it is, and there is nothing more than what physics gives us. But currently known physics is incomplete, is most probably even wrong. You know all the debates about dark matter, dark energy, which is a nice way, in fact, to say that we don't know how to describe the, say, 94% or so of the energy matter of the universe. The figure might be slightly wrong, but something like that. So it's basically, because if people speak about dark matter and dark energy, it looks as if we knew, but in fact it's just a different way to say we don't know how to deal with it. So currently known physics is incomplete, is most probably wrong. And so why think in the first place that physics gets it right? And then when you look to neurosciences, experiments show correlations between brain states and mental states. But brain states don't explain or allow to predict mental states. I think this is a common mistake making in the literature, in the interpretation of neuroscientific experiments. They don't explain, in fact, mental states, or they don't allow to predict mental states. There is a correlation. This is what the experiments show. And once again, about neuroscience studies only brain states and can't say anything about mental states. Physicalism is, in fact, a metaphysical and not a scientific statement. It's not a scientific research program, but it's a metaphysical program. So why is physicalism a metaphysical statement? Physics doesn't say, or science doesn't say that all that exists is described by physics. This all-exclusive statement is not a statement that science can make. That's a metaphysical statement. I think we have to challenge physicalism. So, for neuroscience, but also for thinking about divine action in the world. And so we have to take creation as the starting point of theistic thinking about the world. And instead of starting with physics, I think we have to start with creation. And here's a quote from Henri Blocher. Instead of the natural world, theology finds its starting point in God, the semper agens, so who always acts. It tells of his acts before asking about being. The starting point, taught by Scripture, is the creator-creature pattern. We cannot rise ourselves higher and dominate the constitutive structure. We cannot subsume it under an all-embracing notion of being. It involves a real duality, non-symmetrical, absolute independence on one side, total dependence on the other. So I think we have to change the starting point. Not start with physics and then try to get God into the picture, or even get human beings into the picture, but start to change the starting point. So I'm making a more radical move, and my proposition is more radical. So don't start with physics, start with creation. How does this work? It makes place for miracles. I'm not staying too long with this question, but it makes place for miracles. Miracles is an event brought about by God without above or against natural means, so that's the very traditional definition of miracles, and I think it's a definition you can allow. Four, I'm not discussing all the difficult issues related to it, but just to point out that miracles don't allow for a scientific model. And you don't have to ask for any scientific model, because miracles are, by definition, what is not captured by physics or by science. So, if you accept to take creation as a starting point, you allow for miracles, which physicalism would exclude. But for the moment, we have just, I would say, two opposite ways of God acting in the world. So we have miracles, where there is no scientific account to be had, and we have what sometimes is called general providence. So God acting, in fact, with or in accordance with natural means. In this case, divine action is just in accordance to laws of nature, and therefore we have there is no question about how to account for God's action in the world or of conflict between divine action and the scientific description, because they coincide. So the atheist could complain that general providence adds an unnecessary second level of causality, because he would say, well, it's sufficient to have the natural means, to have the scientific description. We don't need the metaphysical add-on to say that, and God, in fact, upholds the natural means. But here, I would say the atheist sees an unnecessary causal level, but it's only unnecessary from his or her point of view. It's not unnecessary from the theist point of view. And so we are, I would say, on equal grounds. So general providence doesn't provide an argument for God's action in the world, but it's quite acceptable for the theist to say we need this additional layer because all natural means need to be upheld by God's action. But what is slightly insufficient at this point is that we have a kind of dualist account. So you have miracles on one side, no scientific account, you have general providence on the other side, but there doesn't seem to any bridge. And so I think to get a more integrated view, you have to move beyond what I call physicalism plus miracles. Perhaps I should explain the term first. There would be, it's not my viewpoint, but you could argue that God created a physicalist world, so a world where everything which exists is described by physical laws, and there is nothing else than physical laws. And from time to time, God intervenes in this physical world and does certain things, does miracles. It would be, I think, a possible world. It's not the world I think the Bible shows us, and it's not a very convenient or coherent world, but I think it's a possible world. But we have to move beyond this idea, and the key notion for me is there, in fact, non-reductionism. And in a more robust sense than in non-reductive physicalism. In fact, we live in a non-reductive world. Why? So at least from the biblical account, there is first of all the duality between God and the world itself. This excludes a strong physicalism, a strong strong reductionism, because there is this duality between God and the world. And as I said, I think you need to take creation as creation as a starting point of your view, so you have to accept this duality. And sometimes people say, okay, but this is your faith, and so why do you bring your faith in? But it's also faith to say that there is only this world. It's a different kind of faith, but it's also faith. So so if you accept creation, you have the duality between God and the world. You have, according to Genesis 1, different spheres of existence. So the different days of creation, plants and animals created according to their sort. The very important theme in Genesis of separation between day and night, between water above, water below, between land, firm land, and sea. So it's a very important theme in Genesis 1 to have this separation theme. And in particular, you have human beings created in the image of God. So very, very specific, I would say, human beings, which tells against the possibility to have one description for all these different spheres. In fact, non-reductionism is a flagship of neo-Calvinism. So people like Abraham Kuyper, like Abraham Doyeweerd, and I take it to be a very important intuition in our way to handle with science and with physics especially. What Doyeweerth in particular says is that reductionism is an immanent substitute for the unity which the world finds in God. Because if you believe in the Creator, you can accept the different aspects of the world without trying to reduce one aspect to another, because there is an underlying unity which you find in the transcendent Creator. But if you give up the transcendent Creator, then you have two ways to go. Either you go for a completely fragmentary view of nature, of reality, not of nature, but of reality. So you give up on any possibility to unite reality. So you could say you go postmodern relativist. Yeah? Or you could try and keep and find some unity. And scientists typically are not postmodern, so they want to find some unity in reality. And then the answer is reductionism. But it's a kind of nostalgic souvenir or memory of the unity which creation finds in the Creator God. So, just to give you, but if you accept a non-reductionist view, then the very first, in fact, proposition of non-reductive physicalism, and in fact of all the accounts of divine action which you find in the science and theology literature, has to be challenged. In fact, there are no objects which are only physical, and which perhaps it's a kind of provocative thesis, but I try to explain it using the Doyeweerthian framework. It's just wrong to start out with physical objects. And what Doyeweerth proposes is are several modal aspects of reality. So I have to apologize because I used a PowerPoint presentation which I had prepared in French, and so you have the French translations of the Doyeweerthian terms there, but it's very easy in fact to find the English equivalent, and I really apologize because Doyeweerth didn't write in French, so you have to back translate the texts. He distinguishes 15, or according to the text, 13, 14, 15 modal aspects. It doesn't really matter what the exact amount of these modal aspects is. There is some debate about it, and I'm happy to change this. But the basic idea is, I think, very interesting. What he says is, there are no physical objects. Say, take a stone. A stone, sure, is a physical object in the sense that it's subject to physical laws of motion. But a stone can also be part of an economical discourse. Yeah, a precious stone, it can have economic value, or you can speak about it. So in a certain sense, it's also an object of linguistics. So there is a linguistic aspect to the stone. What is different is if the object exists in a sphere with only passive properties, or with passive and active properties. So a stone exists in a passive and in an active way in the cinematic domain, because it can be moved, but it can move also. But in the economic sphere, it only has passive attributes because it cannot speak, but it can be spoken of. But human beings exist more fully, you could say, in the different spheres because they can also speak. So they also have active, active properties in the sphere of linguistics. And I think that this kind of multidimensional approach to reality fits very well, in fact, with the creation worldview, yeah, where you get this kind of multidimensional reality from Genesis 1, and especially because of the rootedness of reality in the transcendent Creator. Because physical objects, so even if you take, say, the stone or the atom, the molecule, there are thought of. There are, okay, I'm not going to use the word design. I'm not using in the more narrow sense of a challenging design, but in the sense that they are created. And if they are created, in fact, they are coming out of a mind. yeah, of spirit. So there is a kind of spiritual dimension, even, say, to the atom or the molecule. And so it's not just physics. It's from the outset a much richer reality. And physicalism is, in fact, a negation of the scientific spirit. So a quote from Robin Collingwood, who says this: the idea of a science for an ancient Greek was not only the idea of a science of X, but the idea of the complete science of X. There could be only one science of a given thing, for unless it grasped the essence of the thing, it was not a science of it. And one thing had only one essence. When that was discovered, all the properties of the thing could be deduced. So that's the old, say, ancient Greek notion of science. But the modern, say, notion of science since Galileo is much more modest, and I think many people don't realize it. The modern science, in fact, is a much more modest, humble enterprise. Because modern science doesn't aim at the essence of things. Yeah? We study the behavior of things under certain circumstances, under certain aspects. And so it's always the specific tag on a scientific enterprise. So we ask very specific questions. And it's the very, say, constraints of the scientific method, of the modern scientific method, which leads to much more precise results. So it's a more powerful tool, but it's a tool which is meant to be limited from the outset. And so this is, I think, why you can claim that physicalism is, in fact, a negation of the scientific spirit and not an extrapolation of it. And this means, in the end, that there are no scientific account of divine action is to be had. In that sense, it may come as a disappointment. I don't offer you any alternative, say, to Pockenholt's model or to Arthur Peacock's model, because I just think there is nothing to be had as a scientific account of divine action, but it leads to a rich picture of created reality and to a coherent picture of created reality, because it allows to explain several features of it. First of all, it provides foundation for the modern scientific method. So I guess you're familiar with it. Believing in creation gives you the belief in the natural order, the possibility that human beings can understand this natural order, that it's worthwhile to explore natural order, etc. So it provides you with a foundation for the modern scientific method, which physicalism doesn't. It makes room for miracles. So an atheist wouldn't be very happy with it, but if you believe that miracles have occurred in history, it's a good thing to have a worldview which makes room for it. And it leads to multiple sciences. It delivers you from the search for the one fundamental science. Most physicists are very strong with this program. Biologists and psychologists don't really like it. And I think it's very interesting to see that creation allows you to have different sciences interacting with each other, but not reducing to each other. And it allows you for an account, I think, for the mind-body duality as well. So it gives you a unique place of human beings, and once again you escape these reductionist approaches of the human mind. And, as an add-on, it explains the attraction of reductionism. So you not only end up with a non-reductionist view, but you also can explain why reductionism is so attractive. I think there's another reason I didn't mention. Reductionism is also interesting because if reductionism works, it gives us a lot of additional information. And there are reductionist projects which succeeded. So chemistry, typically, for example, was reduced to physics by quantum mechanics. So that's very interesting when reductionism works. But reductionism is certainly not an overall metaphysical program which should work in all cases, and creation gives you an account why this overall project is so interesting and so attractive. And I want to close with a quote from C.S. Lewis. about the mind-body duality and about the impossibility to reduce, in fact, reason to science or to scientific explanation. You may be familiar with this argument in his book on miracles. It's the famous argument from chapter 3, so if you haven't read the book and the chapter 3, then you really have to read it before the end of the day, I would say, because I think it's very basic and provides an argument why you can't reduce reason to science. And then he says, Christian doctrine would be fantastic only if the present frontier situation between spirit and nature, so which is what he is exposed to, so in humans, yeah? Okay, let me start the sentence again. Christian doctrine would be fantastic only if the present frontier situation between spirit and nature in each human being were so intelligible and self-explanatory that we just saw to be the only one that could ever have existed. But is it? In reality, the frontier situation is so odd that nothing but custom could make it seem natural, and nothing but the Christian doctrine can make it fully intelligible. What C.S. Lewis says is that we can establish, you know, that there is a frontier situation between mind and body in human beings. So the Christian doctrine in a certain sense asserts that this is not the only frontier situation, that there are other frontier situations, especially God coming in and acting in nature. And so we could exclude the Christian doctrine if the mind-body, you know, duality would be a kind of self-explanatory, would be obvious, intelligible, etc. Then we could say, okay, we understand this, we don't need anything else. But we don't. And then Christian doctrine comes in and gives us an account, not an account, but gives us a view of reality which allows for this mind-body duality. And it confirms, the idea that this mind-body duality is part of a bigger picture, of a bigger non-reductionist picture, which allows also for the duality between the creator and the world. On discussion. So, The question is why is the present science wrong, and what are the arguments for this? Why do I think that the present science is wrong? So the first argument would in fact be just an argument of history. All past science was wrong. Why would the present science be right? So classical mechanics was wrong. It's classical mechanics is no. Classical mechanics is under certain circumstances a limiting case of present day physics, but even to establish the limiting case is quite a complicated matter. And they say the overall metaphysical, so there's a difference between truth and usefulness.
I think there's a difference that within the realm of demonstration it stayed true, but the realm of explanation expanded. And once the realm of explanation expanded, the conceptual framework had to change very much, and that I agree with fully, yes.
Yeah, so the conceptual framework is certainly completely different.
I share your suspicion about dark energy.
I just say, it doesn't mean that we can't use present-day science to do a lot of things and a lot of useful things, but the kind of metaphysical or general picture you get of reality from present-day science, I think, will be wrong, as it has been wrong for science of the past. And another argument would be that the incompatibility of general relativity and quantum mechanics. So if our best-known physical theories are not coherent, consistent, if you can't come up with at least if we don't know that they are consistent, then, probably both of them are wrong. Anyway.
So, when I was as a young Christian studying physics in the grammar school, I got in by God's providence, I started to read Pascal's book on Penzias. And I was approaching that book with very much suspicion, because what this Asian scientist can tell us in this modern time. But I was shocked, you know, when I went through, I found it fantastic book, and actually until now I think the Christian apologetics must always come back to it. And what is the basic problem there, or what he attacks, is the pride of reason.
Mm-hmm.
In the time when the reason was starting to be pride.
Yeah.
And I would understand, for instance, Heisenberg uncertainty principle or indeterminism of quantum mechanics, mm-hmm. not as a way where there is a gap for action of God,
mm-hmm.
but showing that our pride, human pride, that we will know everything is limited. And we cannot know everything, because Heisenberg uncertainty principle is explicitly showing us. Even you said that it is not a matter of getting knowledge, but it is principle. So,
yeah.
So it means that we have to be more humble by these facts, and that we cannot argue that God is using that, but we can argue that we do not understand even the nature which has, or the science which has put our prejudice of our superiority, mm-hmm. that we will understand everything. We will not.
Mm-hmm.
And what is great about physics is that it is the science which has found its own limitations.
Mm-hmm. So we're getting into deep waters, because we get into the interpretation of quantum mechanics indeterminacies. What I understand of it, and my understanding is limited, is that it's not about limits of human reasons, but it's at least there is a way to read quantum mechanics in a very realistic way, and to say these are not indeterminacies in the sense that we don't know, and that there is a deeper reality down there which is determined, and so we just don't know what it is. But that in a certain way you have to read it as objective indeterminacy. So it's not a limit of human reason, but it's a way how the world is. But but then I agree that they're different.
It limits our ability to say that we will know everything.
Yeah.
It's what we can know.
To predict.
Yeah. Not what God can know.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you, Lydia, for a most thought-provoking talk. I'm just wondering about the points that you were making, basically the foundation of what you were saying. Mm. You were saying that you were looking for a place where divine action might be true.
Mm.
Right? And how about if you don't regard it as something, oh, God somehow fits into here, but rather God is underneath using all these things still. Mm. And it's not a matter of sort of placing God in this bit, because one's in danger of a God of the gaps idea, which is always a dangerous line of thinking. So, particularly in the light of some scriptures which are very profound, like Romans 1:20, the invisible things of God are clearly seen, but also Colossians 1, which says, by him all things consist, which I think is one of the most profoundest verses impinging on physics in the Bible. By him all things consist. Now that's, to me, strongly suggesting that it's not pantheism, please don't think that line, I'm not thinking that at all, it's transcendent God, but that he is supporting everything, but not necessarily in a dualistic way. It's actually involved in the physics that we've found, but that is certainly not everything of it.
Mm-hmm.
If God was not supporting the universe by his word, I suggest, everything would collapse and will collapse one day. That's how I see it biblically.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a matter of finding a box where God is.
Mm-hmm.
God is in every single thing, but not pantheistically.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I totally agree that you can't, that you shouldn't go for God of the Gaps account, but that say a worldview which takes creation seriously implies that God, in fact, is active wherever and whenever, all over the place, and the immanence, divine immanence, in that sense, is just implied by the very traditional, theology. Sometimes, in fact, people would say, oh, we need something like panentheism to make room for divine immanence, but I think just a robust view of God's providence is quite enough. You don't need to go for these kind of innovations of panentheism. So if I, perhaps just to make clear what I try to do is, first I try to push your line of argument against a couple of current accounts of divine action in the literature, which I think in the end comes down to put God into somehow, so either quantum mechanical or chaos theory, etc. And so there is a philosophical or theological problem with these accounts. I try to show that there are also scientific, physical difficulties with these accounts, and I think this is it's important to argue in a certain sense on their own ground and show your own accounts won't go through, even just if you regard physics. So if there's a problem for God, or if there was a problem for God acting in Newton's world, there would be a problem also for God acting in, say, Einstein's world or say Heisenberg's world. But then you have to challenge the proposition that there is a problem for God acting in Newton's world. So that is the first line of argument. And the other is I try, perhaps not possible, but I try to go beyond the just the statement that God is active in everything. Because, as a Christian I accept it on the basis of biblical revelation, but is there a way to make it not acceptable, because for that you need the Holy Spirit, but a way to make it relevant even for the unbeliever? And is there a way to tell him it's not just an add-on, which I add on because I believe in God, and so we agree on the physics, and then you stay there, and I put God on top or in beneath or whatever. So, but is there a way that I can show that my own account, that the creation account is better than, or stronger, or more relevant, or richer than, more coherent than in fact you the physicalist account, and then I think, for example, to show that physicalism is in itself an incoherent notion, that it doesn't come out of physics. That doesn't come out of physics is interesting. To show that creation provides a foundation for science itself, that it provides a place for the mind-body duality. I think it's interesting. So this is the way I try to go beyond just affirming by faith or on the grounds of revelation that God is active in everything. And plus, I think the mind-body duality, or if you don't like duality, if you just the unique place of human beings in nature has biblical grounds because of humans being created in the image of God, and there are biblical texts making a parallel between the Trinity, so the persons in the Trinity, between creation and the world. Or the relation between the creator and the creator, and human beings being in the image of God means that there is something to be learned from humans, about God and about the relationship between God and the world. And it's a way of, I would say, the painter representing himself in the picture. So in a certain sense, there is a kind of model. There's a kind of model of the relationship between the creator and the world in the human being itself. And so human beings transcending, in a certain sense, the natural order by being spiritual, by being able of reasoning, thinking, etc. And so there is a kind of parallel, a kind of analog, and we can learn something about the creator-creation relationship from the very unique character of humans.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, there was a question over here.
I think it's a brief question. Near the start, when you were talking about why quantum mechanics doesn't leave space yeah.
for God. You said, at least in this version, you said, if as long as the laws of quantum mechanics are valid, not even an omniscient being can know something that's indeterminate. And that, at first reading, that sounded as if possibly God was being subjected to some, some law of physics. And I wondered whether it's satisfactory to simply rephrase it as, if God has created a physical system with indeterminacy, then he will not violate that by determining it for himself. Or put it another way.
Yeah, so the question is about the phrase, in fact, in the handout, that even an omniscient being couldn't know the indeterminate values attached to physical systems. To be quite honest with you, I'm not absolutely sure about this point, but I try to explain my current thinking on it. But I'm a little bit on the edge of what I understand of quantum mechanics here. What I'm referring to is the very idea that that, as far as I understand it, the indeterminacies are objective, so they're the pattern to the system. And it's not only that we don't know, for example, the momentum and the location of a particle, but even if you think or if you attribute a precise value of both these parameters, you get into trouble. So these are the Bell inequalities, and it's even the attribution of determinate values which would contradict, which would violate quantum mechanical laws. So I'm not saying that God couldn't do it, but then it's against the quantum mechanical laws. And what all these scientists, theologians try to do is to find an account of divine action which doesn't violate the laws. So, and as long as you don't violate them, then you can't have determinate, or at the same time, determinate values of both.
It's just wrong to think in terms of exact values. You have mm-hmm. distributions for things. Yeah, the uncertainty is just part of the model. So, it's just the exact value doesn't exist. That's the way to think. It's not that it can't be known. It's not even that God can't define it. It just doesn't make sense within quantum mechanics.
Yeah. So it's just a point of affirming what I said. If I understand that attributing exact values to indeterminate observables doesn't make sense inside the quantum mechanical model. So you can always move outside quantum mechanics. So you can allow for a miracle. That's sure. Yeah. But as long as you stay inside the quantum mechanical models, it's not just that we don't know the values, but they aren't there. So in that sense. Okay. Whatever. Go ahead and then.
Maybe I would try to help with this question about the indeterminism in quantum mechanics. Basically, what is indeterminate a priori is the result of a measurement. Mm-hmm. Which means in the quantum world you can have a system that has a perfectly well-defined state, but the numbers that we want to know about it are not sharp. Mm-hmm. And if you try to measure such a system, what happens at the end is a probability, a distribution of some values. And that is how I would see this this question of indeterminism, and this idea that there might be some hidden parameters that was something that Einstein was strongly in favor of, because he was that famous saying of him that God doesn't owe us. And if I recall well, I think that the whole mind experiment of Einstein, Podolsky, Rosen paradox was the motivation for Einstein for that was that he wanted to disprove the quantum mechanics and these basic ideas of it. But in the meantime, we know that what the whole idea of the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paradox is actually what happens in nature. Mm. So it is a paradox. It looks illogical, but it happens. So maybe just briefly to say that the quantum world is just not. It functions on its own logic, and it just doesn't work the way we expect based on our experiments in the macroscopic world. And maybe one more thing, I would really like to comment this approach to communication between science and religion and maybe apologetics, because I think if we start from the idea that a believer owes a proof of what they believe, we end up with something that has to be very weak. You either have a God that cannot do anything because everything is determined, or you have a God who rules the world by rigging the dice at that moment of the measurement where there are some probabilities, and then God chooses in a moment by rigging the dice what will happen, and then makes miracle like that, or things like that. And that is very weak. On the other hand, if we just boldly say God is outside of the world, above the world, created the world, we cannot prove it, we don't owe the proof, but on the other hand, we can put forward a worldview, just like you did at the end, that provides a rich picture of the created world, reality, foundation for modern science, for rational exploration of the world, because it is God has made it with a certain order, and then also explanation that makes room for miracles, multiple scientists, gives a frame to put the mind-body duality in, and so on and so on. I think that is something that is much more powerful. We cannot prove God, but we can show how this worldview actually helps us understand all these things that otherwise would be very troubling, very difficult to understand.
Yeah, I totally agree with this way of putting things, and perhaps I may just add one thing. It's very strange to see people attracted to quantum mechanical indeterminacies to explain, say, human action or divine action, because indeterminate behavior is not better than determinate behavior or deterministic behavior when it comes to free action. Because when we say that somebody is acting freely, it doesn't mean, oh, you don't know what he's doing and why he's doing, and it's just falling out of his head or so. Yeah. There is something, at least in free, responsible action, which is, in fact, very determined. Yeah. I don't think that the idea that quantum mechanics, even, or any indeterministic theory, is better than a deterministic theory. You need a different dimension, you need a different layer to reality, you need something more than this kind of explanation. I totally agree.
I think one of the problems that we get into, that those of us too who have got a science background, is that it's almost as if we're trying to compete with science, and science, God is there, theology is there, and science is there, and we're trying to synthesize the two. And I think what we do is forget, was it Newton who said, we are discovering God's thoughts after him? And I think we need, as Christians, to not be on the back foot. We need to, I think, remember that there's a language which we communicate with. God reveals himself, the scriptures are the human language, which is a means of communication. And I think science, really, the first talk this morning, I think, put it very well, really, is that when, at its heart, science, much of it based upon mathematics, is a language that we are using as humans to observe this world that as Christians we believe God has created. So by definition, that language is incomplete and it's developing. And if you think of Newton's laws and then how somebody said, I think last year was, well, you know, science has been proven wrong because Newton was proven wrong. He wasn't wrong. It's just that Einstein came along and widened the scope of what Newton was able to do. What does that illustrate? I think it illustrates that our language, basically mathematics, that we use to describe God's creation is developing. But I think, of course, those who are not Christians would see science as being ultimately able to explain everything. But I think our first speaker has wonderfully illustrated that that is just not possible. But does that mean that science is wrong or science is not useful or we dismiss it? No, because this language of science actually is very useful to enable us to mount hypotheses, to test those hypotheses, and then to develop systems that maybe are useful or are workable. In my area, for example, of computer speech and language recognition, we develop sophisticated computer models to enable people to converse with machines. Does that in any way correspond to the reality of how we do it? Absolutely not. It's some big statistical machine that works on the basis of probabilities. But it's useful. Well, some people think it's useful, others might not. But you see the point I'm illustrating. Yeah. So, but do we now elevate the mathematics behind all of that to some sort of reality? Mm-hmm. I don't think we should. I think we say it's a useful language, but somehow if we can get this argument across from our first speaker that actually there is belief involved in the mathematics and in the foundations of science, then, you know, we can start with our belief, but you have your beliefs. We have some other beliefs as well together in the science, but we're basically starting from a level playing field rather than a, you know, that's this and that's that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree. And what I think is very interesting about the, say, creation worldview or biblical worldview or however you want to call it, is that it allows you both to make sense of science and to give it its value, and it allows you to resist, say, the reductionism or the scientistic spirit, or to make science an overall explanation of reality. So it's very interesting that it allows for science, but it gives science its proper place, and it goes against the absolutization of science. And therefore, I think Christians should make a very specific contribution even to the public understanding of science. I would like to give the opportunity to those who haven't asked a question right now, perhaps especially to non-English, native English speakers, because it's always more difficult, I know it from experience, to speak in a group when it's not your native language. So does anybody who hasn't asked a question now, and especially those who are not native English, would, so the question is, quantum mechanics was developed in the 10s and 20s of the 19th century, in order to account for experiments which classical mechanics or classical physics couldn't explain. And then later on there were other theoretical frames coming along, but they wouldn't be accepted and people would stay with the, say, standard quantum mechanical frame. It's quite intriguing to see that there are different, in fact, you have different metaphysical pictures of reality coming out of, say, standard quantum mechanics and, say, of Bohm's, for example, theory. But, in fact, both lead exactly to the same experimental results. In fact, Bohm's theory was constructed that it would exactly yield the same results as standard quantum mechanics. But the metaphysical picture behind it is completely different. Which is probably, I think, just a pointer to the fact that physical theories are always underdetermined by experiments, so there is a kind of openness to it. Most of the time it's pretty difficult to come up with more than one good theory. This is already difficult, so it's very rare that physicists will come with two theories explaining the same results. But in theory, it's always possible, and quantum mechanics is a place where it's possible. So why prefer the standard account to the Bohm's account? Basically, I think because Bohm is more complicated and gives you a very weird, it's even stranger metaphysical picture than standard quantum mechanics. Standard quantum mechanics is already quite difficult, so to imagine that the world is like this, but then if you take Bohm's theory, it's even more strange. So, perhaps it reminds us also of the fact that science is always done in a community, and there's a kind of consensus coming along, and so you just do science in a certain setting.
We're in the business of eliminating the weaker theories. That's the business of science, is to eliminate...
Yeah, but, say, Bohm's theory, as far as I know, is just equivalent in its experimental results. You can't disprove it.
It's simplicity plus expanding explanatory power.
Yeah, it's but
simplicity plus expanding ability to explain new things. And
yeah.
The Bohm's theory explains less.
Fails that. And when you have two different, like Schrodinger and Heisenberg formulations of quantum mechanics are totally different. And they seem like two alternative quantum theories at the beginning. But there's a complete mathematical equivalence between them, and you can prove it. It's an isomorphism between them. So, it ends up that if you think you have another theory, it really isn't another theory. And there's something very stubborn about reality that just won't let you play any game you want to with it. I'm just speaking from my experience as a physicist all my life.
Is there a last question of somebody who didn't?
Is it right that you say the mind-body duality is essentially kind of an intractable problem for science, and the Christian worldview provides a kind of a framework and even a precedent for problems that are intractable because there's a bigger picture beyond it? So do you think it's surprising that God did make that an intractable problem? Would it? Because feasibly, I personally wouldn't have a problem with God, kind of with our mind emerging from our physicality in kind of explicable means, in a kind of non-deterministic fashion, but in a way that we could understand in terms of biology, any more than I have a problem with us being able to understand why the disciples were able to see the living Lord Jesus with their eyes, and we can explain that in terms of physical explanations as well.
Yeah. Okay, so I've argued that the mind-body problem can be solved in scientific terms. And so you ask, why would God do anything like this? So but I should be clearer about what I say when I say you can't solve it in scientific terms, because it doesn't mean that the mind is a substance floating around and not having, say, a physical or biological or neurochemical incarnation, if you want to say. So I'm not speaking about this kind of ghosts, although I believe in intermediate states. I believe in the possibility for humans to exist without their body. So, but certainly in this life, as far as we know, probably at least, the mind always works with the brain. So there are some weird stairs we're not getting into it. But say in normal circumstances, the mind would always work with a brain substance. But I guess it depends on what you mean by science. And so it's not in the sense that the mind-body duality is something we can't talk about, we can't describe, is completely incomprehensible, etc. But it is following Lewis and others, I see a kind of contradiction in terms to ask for a scientific explanation of reason, because reason is sort of in a nutshell, it's the argument that reason is about norms, it's about true and false, but science is about facts. And so you can't go from facts to value. So it's a normative thing. So, but yeah, then you could go for a kind of scientia, so in a sense of wisdom, and then probably you could get the mind-body duality into it. Okay, thank you.